most people's coming out story usually ends with their friends and families either embracing them or rejecting them due to their own prejudices.
For actor Tita Alexis Allen, she was forced out of the closet by her father when he came out to her as also being gay. But that wasn't his only secret. She soon suspected him of working undercover as a secret agent for the Vatican. In her new book, Hiding Out, a memoir of drugs, deception, and double lives, Tina Alexis Allen chronicles her life growing up the youngest of 13 children in a devout Catholic family headed by her mysterious father, Sir John, who was knighted by the Pope. After coming out, the two of them led a decadent life partying at gay clubs together, drinking to excess, and exploring their sexuality, all while keeping the rest of the world and their family in the dark.
Listen as Tina Alexis Allen talks about her incredible story and why she still doesn't fully know everything about her father's double life. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Hello?
Hello, is this Tina Alexis Allen?
This is she.
Hi, Tina. This is Fausto.
And Mark from Feast of Fun. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Fausto and Mark. How are you guys?
Tina, before we begin, can you take us off of speakerphone, please?
No, I'm actually on my Bluetooth. Would you like me to go onto my phone?
Yeah, could you try that just to see how that sounds better?
Sure, absolutely.
How's that?
Oh, a million times better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Feels better for me, too. It feels more intimate all of a sudden.
Oh, that's
good. I like
good.
That.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I didn't send you a kiss on my text for nothing.
Congratulations on your work for the TV show Outsiders.
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. It was so much fun. We hate that it didn't get renewed, but, you know, they sold the network, as you may know. So WGN got sold and they got rid of all their pretty much all their original scripted programming. But boy, did we have fun for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, you got to wield an axe in the episode. Did the director get to say, Tina, bring me the axe?
What was so great about that is it was my first day on set. I had never met anyone, and they had brought me on as this sort of, they thought, reoccurring that was going to be on for like 5 episodes. And it was about the midway point of the first season. And it was literally my first day on set, and I had to go at David Morse, who's about 7'7"
wow.
with that axe. But it was a nice way to meet the gang.
You're like, I'm here.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't miss her. I guess she's here to play.
Mark, you were saying that Tina's also involved in another project.
You were in another one, Moving Mountains, which also happened like in coal country. Are you getting typecast as like a Miss Appalachia?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my character on Outsiders was quite a bit different. I mean, on that mountain, we don't really know how to learn, you know, read or write. The woman in Moving Mountains, she was actually a bit of an activist. Mm. So she was, you know, let's just say more schooled than Shern. You know, she used her mind a lot more. Shern used her, you know, axe and a gun and stuff. Yeah, I think I got that accent down pretty well. So yeah, they do call me up for that hillbilly stuff.
Well, you know, I mean, the coal is such a big resource in that community. And, you know, so much of activism centers around that even to this day is the people that are just kind of destroying that environment around there.
So it was amazing. I didn't know at that point, it's been now a few years. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really clear about what mountaintop removal was until I had kind of heard of it, but I didn't really physically get it until I saw. And then in this little town that we shot in called Pi, they basically had their beautiful mountain like cut through. And then the top of it was, of course, blasted off. And there went basically, mm-hmm. you know, what they loved more than anything, probably why they all moved there or stayed there or what have you. So,
sure.
Yeah, it's pretty tragic.
It, yeah. Not only does it destroy the beauty of the wilderness, but also, too, it's an environmental hazard because, like, that stuff leaches off into the water streams and can just cause pollution for miles around.
Yeah. Trish Bragg is the woman that Moving Mountains is based on. And she was, you know, like, you know, regular mom, you know, doing her thing mm-hmm. with raising kids. And that's what happened. Her water supply was contaminated and people started getting really sick, and anyway, just snowballed from there. She was like the, you know, Aaron Brockovich of Cole. And it was a very powerful movie and a very powerful project to work on. I loved, actually, it was my introduction to West Virginia. And the people are, they're so passionate and beautiful. And it's interesting about one other thing about Appalachia and West Virginia is I also learned working on Outsiders that, you know, the language that we still hear in Appalachia that some people label whatever they label it, you know what I'm saying? It happens to be Shakespearean. You know, that's language that literally goes back, and they didn't change their language as much because they were on the mountain, and we sort of got into new language and slang and this and that. But actually, they're the smart ones. They're the ones that are speaking the pure language. It's not the way we've, you know, labeled it. It's actually quite the reverse. So,
well, certainly they do get a bad rap. And especially when I think back when we'd have like the robber barons from the 1900s, and they were, you know, forcing these men down into the coal mines, and they were dying, and they were living under terrible conditions. And they all wore like redneck handkerchiefs to protest against the big man and corporate greed. And now we have flipped that completely around. So a redneck is now an uneducated hillbilly. So we've turned against the proletariat.
Exactly.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So when you say redneck, you know, realize where that comes from.
It's an attempt to co-opt progressive movements in Appalachia.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Well, so, Tina, you've had an extraordinary life. And when we got your memoir, Hiding Out, a memoir of drugs, deception, and double lives, we were enthralled. And we're very looking forward to talking to you about your courageous story.
Thank you so much. It's definitely been a long road and a lot of healing. And that's the good news, is that I'm standing and happy and strong. But yeah, I look back on it, and sometimes people say things like you just said, courageous. And I think, well, it was just my life, you know, like we don't know what we don't know. But as I have more and more distance from it, and I feel like I've moved into a lot healthier ways of being, it does strike me now and again, like, wow, that actually happened.
It was super important in your prologue, your first chapter of the book, to let people know I'm okay. I've been through this, but I'm okay. Don't worry. Why did you feel it was so important to reassure them in the very beginning?
Well, because probably two reasons. One is that I made a very conscious choice, which I think I say also in the prologue, to write this memoir from my young adult voice. First person, no narrator, no explanation, just this is who I am, this is what I do. And I think that not having the context of a narrator, which, you know, many memoirs do, I was basically saying, you're going to get on this this roller coaster and you're going to take this ride. But I wanted people to know before they got on the roller coaster. And, you know, there's obviously trauma that happens that's very serious. And I wanted people to know that they could be assured, if they stopped and paused, that the person that they were reading about is okay, like more than okay. So it was very important that I wrote it pure, but it was also important for me that I didn't, you know, take anyone into a space where they started to feel maybe unsafe or worried for me. I want them to just know that in the back of their head.
You grew up as the youngest of 13 kids in a town called Chevy Chase, Maryland, which for me was a little confusing because I was like, what's Chevy Chase doing in this story?
It's not that funny of a story for Chevy Chase to be in it.
Yeah. and really, what strikes me a lot is the image on the cover of the book of you as a little girl sleeping next to an apple.
I know. It's like you couldn't even write this shit.
Can you explain to the listeners what was so important about sleeping? You know, most kids had a teddy bear. You had a shiny red apple next to you as you slept.
Well, in fairness, we didn't grow up poor, but there were still 12 older siblings to contend with. So I'm pretty sure, as the story goes, that when I was 3 or 4, I think that picture, I'm about 4, I used to take a nap. And when I did, I would always take my apple with me. And I realized that it's probably because I knew by 3 or 4 that if I didn't take it with me, it would be eaten by the time I got back. I wouldn't find it. So I think it was probably some level of awareness that there were a lot of big people around me that would probably, you know, grab what wasn't held while I slept. So, yeah.
Fausto was like, he was explaining this. He was like saying this to me. He's like, what terrible parents she had that they didn't provide food for their kids. And I was just like,
Not at all.
Tina, I'm the youngest of 8 kids, also grew up very Catholic. Wow. And so it was like, I know that like, if you didn't come when dinner was called and dinner was eaten, there was no food to eat, you know?
Yeah, and you know that there may be some nights your mom made, you know, drumsticks and chicken wings and some breasts, and you had choices. And if you weren't the first in line, you weren't necessarily going to get the one that you preferred because 12 other people, or in your case, 7 other people went in line before you. But no, my parents certainly provided, and there was plenty of food and all that. But still, I have to say, my mother, you know, I had 5 brothers, as made very clearly in the memoir. But I remember when I was in my teens, my mother, I think I say this in the memoir, that my mom, you know, she'd go to the grocery store, you know, 3 full baskets later, and she'd get Oreos, and she knew I loved them. And God bless her, you know, she'd hide them like in the turkey pan under the counter, because she knew as soon as like my brothers came in, like they'd eat the whole bag. Mm. So it wasn't like she didn't want them to have it, but she already kind of got it that she kind of had to...
My dad hid all the sweets too.
Is that right?
Oh yeah, all the sweets
for himself or for him.
He would dole them out.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, you have to, because I mean, when you're a kid, there's no limit. If there's a bag of Oreos, you're going to eat like as many as your stomach will hold.
Why was it so important though to have this photo on the cover of your book? Because the story is really, you know, in a lot of ways, you've gone through some really difficult. Heartbreaking moments.
Yes. It actually came from a conversation I was having with my editor at HarperCollins, Carrie Thornton, who's amazing. And we were talking, she had seen the photo and she thought that it was symbolically, and I agreed with her, very poignant in terms of, you know, Catholicism and, you know, the reference to Adam and Eve and sin and apple and the fallen fruit and the loss of innocence, which is a lot of, it's not what the book is about, but certainly, my, you know, in my younger childhood, when you read it, you'll see that there were, very, you know, serious instances of me, you know, losing innocence at a time that I shouldn't have. So I think all of that played a part. And I think, you know, just the religion and emotional connotations just seemed like it made perfect sense, even though I was at first like, well, wait, because I'm not a baby in the book. But I think that because we do flashback to some of the younger the traumas that happen, it was poignant to have that. So I happen to actually love the cover. I'm so glad she thought of it, and it was her idea.
Tell us about the man your father was, or at least what you understand him to be, because he was definitely very secretive.
Yeah. So as I reveal, you know, my father shared secrets with me, which is what sort of the heart of the book is about, is this very unconventional relationship I had with this man who had 13 kids with my mother, but also turned out to be gay. And I use that word, even though it seems like it would be confusing. I should call him what, bisexual or fluid if he was living today. But I actually, my experience of him was really as a gay man once he shared his secrets with me. So when I saw him away from the family, I never thought of him as anything but a gay man. So that was very complicated. We shared secrets with each other, and that was bittersweet. On the one hand, it gave me an amazing relationship with him that I had never had. Frankly, I didn't even like him before he started sharing his secrets with me, his double lives and such. But I, of course, he then became my confidant too. And we formed a sort of, as I said, a very sort of stranger than fiction, unconventional relationship, and served a purpose, I think, very important, a very important purpose in each other's life at that time where, you know, people were in the closet and really had to be. And particularly if you were in a religious environment like we were.
How did your dad discover that you were, because you didn't come out to your father. Your father kind of confronted you about you being gay.
I had been, you know, I had dated some guys, you know, when I was younger, but at the time I was with a woman who was quite a bit older than I was. I was 18 at the time, and he just picked up on it. And I guess, you know, when you're part of the family, it's a little easier to pick up on. It blew me away. There was nothing he walked in on or saw. In fact, I described the scene in the book. You know, we were out, so we were public, we were covered, we were not in any way nothing happened obvious that, and he just picked up on it.
Yeah, in the book you say he saw us coming down the stairs and he just knew, and he said, I can tell when two people are in love. And then he comes out to you like right then and there. That must have been like a jaw-dropping moment. Or did you suspect it a little bit? Or
not one iota. Never would have thought in any way, shape or form. And it wasn't even one of those like, oh, now it all makes sense. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that either. It was really like, what just happened?
I mean, you must have had a million questions going through your head when that happened.
Well, it's funny, as you're asking me, I feel like almost I'm having a, you know, emotional memory, sense memory. Mm-hmm. Like I feel all of a sudden sort of stirred up, but not in a bad way, just mm-hmm. in a like, yeah, that intensity of, what, how do I make any sense of this? And I couldn't. That was just way too much, I think, for the rest of the night, for the next night, you know, it took me a long time, but even to sort of catch my breath around it. And yet, because finally now someone in my family knew about me, it was both terrifying and exhilarating because, you know, if you've had to keep a secret in your life, a big secret, whatever that may be, sexuality or otherwise, we all know the burden of what that feels like. And to be able to release that and perhaps a little bit of the shame that goes along with it was pretty exhilarating. And there was some comfort in that in a weird way, but it took a while.
How did your life change once the walls of sexual identity came down between you and your father?
Well, in a weird way, I mean, because he was such a drinker, in some ways I started drinking more, which wasn't a natural, you know, positive, but I started to,
you know. Hello? Hold on a second.
I'm sorry, Tina, it seems we're losing you.
Just dropped out.
If you could restart that. So,
yeah, how did your life change between you and your father once the wall came down?
Well, we started to spend a lot of time together. That became a little complicated inside of the family because it was odd. One day I'm a gal who doesn't like her father, and the next day I'm having, you know, dinner and drinks with him on a regular basis. And now trips, or he's sending me off somewhere on a trip, or he's meeting me in Greece, or he's meeting me in Rome. And so I think even inside of my family, I can remember over the next few years a kind of complication and perhaps even confusion. I can remember a sibling once telling me many years later, once it all came out, that he remembers feeling very sort of envious and jealous at that time because it was sort of all of a sudden I was the favorite. And it's not that it didn't happen to other people in terms of being a favorite, but obviously this was different. So for me, it was sort of like I got a father in a weird way.
Was it benign, or do you feel that he had ulterior motives in terms of maybe grooming you for a job of some kind?
Well, I don't know about, you know, a bigger job, but I do know that it didn't happen, as I said, to other people in my family. Kind of you'd go in and out of favor with my dad. And the older ones who maybe worked in his office before maybe they were a manager for a year, but then they'd go out of favor with him because that was just his personality and he liked to fire people. So then he'd be on to the next. In my case, it was different because it wasn't just I became the favor or the flavor of the month. It was that we were sharing this. So I think there was an authentic, there were a couple things going on, but certainly it was very clear to me that he wanted me to take over his business. I mean, that became clear. And I thought, well, maybe it is just a phase like everyone else has gone through. Mm-hmm. But in my case, it did go on for a long time.
And this is where I find really at the core, the most fascinating aspect of your story is that we still don't know to this day what your dad's business was, because he was a high ranking official with the Vatican. He was knighted by the Pope.
Yeah.
And he was bringing suitcases of money to Russia.
Well, maybe. We don't know, right?
Well, I don't know if he would. Yeah. What I know for sure is that in 1958, he went to Russia, and he also went to Yugoslavia. And no one was going to Russia or any other communist country during that time, certainly not from America. So the fact that he was even there, he certainly wasn't trying to bring a pilgrimage to the Kremlin, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know about the money and if that was part of it, but what I know is, you know, things that I saw over the years getting closer and closer to him and to his business and to just traveling with him a lot. But yes, I've spent probably the last, I'd say solid 2 years, in addition to things that I just questioned back then. I mean, in fairness, I was drunk a lot, so I wasn't really questioning a whole lot. I mean, I was questioning things when I saw them, but I was on such a roller coaster with him on so many levels, from the partying to the clubs to the, you know, managing the fact that he was gay to begin with, still processing. That took a really long time. And the betrayal that I also felt towards my mother specifically for keeping that secret and sort of replacing her in a weird way, even though I know I didn't really, but, you know, he'd pick me to go here or there, whether it was me or not, he truthfully wasn't picking her, but still it brought up a lot of guilt. And anyway, yeah. So as far as his work, I've looked into it. In fact, I might, when I'm done this call, have the opportunity to go meet the Cardinal, if you can believe this.
So this story is unfolding as we speak.
It is. I'm still trying to find out. But I'll just say quickly for anyone who's sort of curious, because I can't talk a lot about it in the book because of just space, but I did sort of summarize what I thought he might be doing. But the problem is that the Vatican does keep secrets. My father never officially worked for the Vatican. He told me, but secret, and he told other people, but he never, it's not like he had a job title or a business card. Mm-hmm. He was a Catholic travel agent. That's what he did. That's what people thought he did. And he did do that. But all those other things, mysteries inside the book and, you know, lead up to the fact that, yes, he was doing some sort of secret work for the Holy See.
He was good friends with people inside the Vatican as well, in the Vatican Bank, which at the time would have been the Vatican Bank. I'm not sure what its standing is today, but certainly in your father's time in the 80s, it would have been the world's largest bank.
Yeah. You know, and because Vatican City is a sovereign nation, there is nothing, there's no transparency. Mm. They don't have to report things. It's up to them. I mean, Pope Francis is, you know, to his credit, trying to make things a little more transparent, but, you know, it's like changing a, you know, centuries old system, and it just doesn't happen with one pope overnight.
And your father kind of clued you into some of those kinds of systems, because your dad insisted one of the popes had been murdered.
Yeah, my father absolutely felt that Pope John Paul I, in his opinion, had been murdered. And there was actually a cardinal in Canada that my father knew quite well. Gagnon, I believe, is his name. He's passed away. But that was sort of in the thick of that, and had actually asked John Paul II to be relieved of his duties in Rome because he was very much scared for his well-being. And he went back to Canada for a while and then I think eventually went back to Rome, but was, you know, sort of got out. So those are the kinds of stories that I would hear. You know, I don't have any facts. I can't hand you a piece of paper and said that happened, but I can say that was my father's opinion.
Do you feel like your father feared for his own safety at any point in time?
You know, he had this funny thing that wasn't funny, haha, but strange, strange thing. He used to often say that he thought the guy over at the other table or the few guys at the other table on more than one occasion were Mossad. And he'd done a lot of work in the Middle East. He did a lot of amazing service in the Holy Land for pilgrimage, you know, not just as pilgrimages, but for orphanages and young students and the Jerusalem University. And, you know, he helped very much in terms of the Arab community during any of the intifadas. And anyway, I think that was one thing that I realized at that age was very odd. And sometimes I'm like, is it just because he's had too much to drink? But it just happened, you know, kind of one too many times.
To explain to the listeners, the Mossad is Israel.
It's Israel's secret service. It's like the CIA in Israel. So
he was, because you know, your dad may or may not have been having sexual affairs with priests inside the Vatican.
Yes, I don't know that. I mean, I do know that he definitely had affairs with priests, that I do know. I don't know for a fact anyone inside of the Vatican, but definitely there's a lot of that, as we all know, has been pretty much now we can say is fact. In fact, I read somewhere recently, I'm not sure who did the study, but that there was an estimate that half of the U.S. bishops in the United States, I mean, U.S. bishops are gay. It doesn't mean they're acting on it. Mm-hmm. But,
no surprise there. Now, your father was referred to, because he was knighted, as Sir John. So growing up as a kid, it must have been kind of weird to have a dad with a title here in the United States, huh?
It was. And besides, he had a British accent. Mm. So most people assumed he was knighted by the Queen. Because most people don't really know, unless you're Catholic, that actually what Knights of the Holy Sepulchre are, or you know what being knighted is in Catholicism. But people go, "Oh, Sir Elton John. Oh, you must be knighted by the by the Queen."
Well, even for Catholics, though, it's pretty rare, because, you know, I went to Catholic school my whole life, and I don't know if I've ever met. I mean, I've heard of the Knights of Columbus, but I don't feel like it's the same thing.
No. Yeah. Basically, it's a modern day, I guess it evolved from the Knights Templar. That's basically what it is. It's people that have done service, and in particular in the Holy Land. And the Knights Templar were the group who protected Jesus's tomb from being raided, from being attacked, you know, through the Middle Ages. And now this is sort of a modern day version. Nobody's, you know, wearing steel and you know, charging on horses, but it's more of an honorary organization where the Pope knights people who are devoted to Catholicism, particularly in the Holy Land.
This is almost sounds like Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
I know.
But with a gay twist.
Exactly. Meanwhile, isn't that cool, though?
You're like, you know, out of the closet to some degree and dating women.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been in a long-term relationship. I'm very happy. I've definitely, you know, consider myself fluid in the sense of, you know, if I wasn't with my partner, who knows who I'd be with. I really believe that in my life, for myself, you know, I see people. Somebody asked me recently, how do I identify? I said, I'm a human being. I don't know. I fall in love with people. But yes, I've definitely been with more women than men, and I'm very happily in a long-term relationship with a woman.
And those people tend to, you know, have breasts most of the time.
They do, which I happen to like a lot.
Now, you actually did a one-woman show, Secrets of a Holy Father, and you actually played your father.
Yes.
What was it like playing your own gay dad?
It was an amazing experience. It was terrifying, first of all, let's be honest. And it was also incredibly, I don't know if healing is the word, but I think it's insightful, because having to at least try to walk in somebody else's shoes and really play him as a character, there was no judgment. It wasn't a funny show. It wasn't supposed to be a joke. Mm-hmm. It was really me, to the best of my ability, transforming myself into him. And what I discovered that was so satisfying is I realized about halfway through my rehearsal process something I had never known before, which is my father didn't want to be such a jerk. You know, when you're a kid and your parents have something that doesn't work for you, you just assume that's the way they are and they mean it, and they, you know, you don't know, you just think mm-hmm. that, because you never really step in their shoes and go, oh, they really feel bad that they're yelling at you or that they act like that. Or, and he was so complicated. And, you know, the truth is sometimes he was, you know, more than sometimes, a real mean SOB, especially to my mother. So
he taunted her to lose 50 pounds. And if she lost the weight, he would take her on a cruise around the world on the Queen Elizabeth. Yeah. And then she actually lost the weight. And he was like, never mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
That must have broken your mother's heart.
Yeah, I think a lot of, you know, a lot of the way he treated her broke her heart. You know, I think that was really difficult for her. And thankfully, at the very end, which I don't say in my book, and I kind of wish I had, I saw him treat her the way he must have when they met, because I never saw him love her unconditionally and just be, you know, the beautiful man that he obviously was inside, that we all are, right? But he didn't, you know, he had so much frustration, and she was the brunt of it. But in the end, I have to say that he really did treat her with enormous love and compassion. Wish it could have been her whole life, but that wasn't. But at least at the end, you know, I got to see that side of him with her, and that was a gift for her, I know.
What were the final moments of your father's life like?
Wow. My dad had a stroke, and I happened to be in L.A. So what I know is he apologized, which I think I mentioned in my book, that there were one of my brothers in particular that he was especially hard on. And he apologized to him. I wasn't there, but my brother shared that with me, and I think would be okay that I'm sharing that with you. Because I think it's important that, I think in his last moments, he wanted forgiveness for things he wasn't so proud of, particularly with some of his kids that he was hard on. That was one in particular. I didn't get back from LA in time for him to be fully conscious. But when I whispered in his ear, he let out a big moan. So I know he knew that I was there. And that was really important to me. So yeah, I think he was probably praying really hard, because he did have a lot of faith. And despite his complicated life, I think he was authentically devoted to the church and to his faith. Regardless of his behavior, he really authentically loved the church.
Was it harder for you to tell your story, or was it harder for you to, you know, navigate being a gay woman? Or was it harder for you to say goodbye to your father?
Can you ask me that a different way? Because I'm not quite sure.
Figure out what for you, like, in, you know, because we always have these challenging moments in our lives. And I'm trying to figure out, like, for you, it seemed, you know, you make it sound so effortless in some ways. But I know that saying goodbye to your father, that, you know, that coming forward with your story and also living your life as a gay woman have all been really challenging. And I'm just curious to know for you, if any of those aspects of your life trump one, and sorry to use that word, but you know, supersede one or the other.
Well, I think because, and when you read the book, not you, but when your audience reads the book, they'll see and read about some very complicated stuff that happened early on. And I think because those things happened to me so young, in terms of even being with a woman that young, I think that in a weird way, the sexuality part of it being with men or women I wasn't as hung up. Yes, I was hiding because I knew I was in a place where people weren't in agreement. But overall, I'd say more of the challenge for me in my life has been to really release the shame about the early trauma. Mm-hmm. I think that's a bigger thing.
About being sexually assaulted as a child?
Yes. Yeah. I'm talking about that feels like that was a big, and also, yeah, by, you know, different people who I do mention in the book, both family mm-hmm. and also teacher. I think that because being so young and confusing sex with love, you know, that took me a really long time, as you'll know from reading the book, that you start sexualizing everything and you don't really know what love is. You think it's sex or sex is love, or it's confusing. And so I think that for me has been maybe the bigger hurdle than my sexual identity. You know, do I want to be with a woman? Do I want to be with a guy? Like, I don't know. Who cares anymore? You know, it's 2018, people, you know, get it. Like,
so in some ways your father kind of saved your life.
I think he did. And I didn't know it. I've changed everyone's name in the book.
Even obviously. Your dad's name?
No, my father is Sir John. But I've changed everyone else's, all the other names. What I was going to say is that, I forgot.
You changed all the names except your father's name.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, so there's one of my girlfriends that is in the book. I was speaking with her, when I started writing it, I had a call with her. I wanted to ask her, did she remember this? And I remember that this happened. And do you remember having private conversations with him where he might have said something that I don't remember he told you, or that kind of stuff? And in that conversation, she said something to me that just floored me. She said, your dad had so much admiration for you. And I was like, what? She said, yeah, he just admired how out you were, how free you were. And I think that because he didn't get to live freely, at least in terms of his sexuality, but he did give me a gift. He gave me such acceptance, even though it was, yeah, really crazy circumstances. But he did. He accepted me, and no one else in my family up to that point knew. And I had at least one person who... just, he did. He really did accept me for that.
He certainly did. But did it seem in some ways fair for him to share that secret with you, especially when it was hidden from your 12 brothers and sisters and then also your mother?
Well, look, it's complicated, isn't it? I mean, yeah. There's no way I could sit here and say to you, well, you know, there's like, you know, it's black and white. Sure. It's not. It's really bittersweet. I mean, I forgive all that, and I understand it. But yeah, at 18, it's a big fucking, excuse me, burden to put on a child, and then knowing that that person will probably keep it from their parent, the other parent, but also this great big family.
Now, you were the only one who knew, and then, of course, you know, your family, the rest of the family finds out about it. In the book, you talk about one sister, really, but, I mean, you also have 11 other brothers and sisters. I mean, what was that like when everyone knew?
It was hard. Mm-hmm. It was really hard, and the thing is, when you grow up in a culture of secrecy, and I still experience some of this today because not all of my family members are thrilled that I'm so public with my life and my father's life. So I think it feels a bit of like a frenzy. And I think at that time it was very hard because everyone is in a state of shock. And even if some of the older ones, which I do think is true, had their own moment of remembering, like, well, that was weird, or I used to think that then, but then of course you brush it away and you go, it's my father, he's got 13 kids, clearly that can't be true. So I think when everybody's all of a sudden, it's like an explosion, it's like, you know, the cliche, the house of cards came down, and I think that's frankly, what it felt like. And I felt responsible. I was responsible to an extent. And I'm responsible again today that New York Daily News had a 2-page spread of every single thing that's ever happened in my life. And now, you know, I've basically, in some ways, I feel like I've done it again, but I also am very, very clear about why and the bigger picture and how important transparency is so that we don't have a legacy in my family of this happening again to anyone.
There's no doubt that your extraordinary life and the burden of keeping all these secrets has had an impact on you as an artist.
And
what I think is really interesting about your life and your career is that you came to acting after a successful career in fashion and business.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying that in past interviews that you've always felt that you were an actor regardless of where you were.
Well, I think that when I look back on it, I mean, I had to act a lot of stuff at a really young age. Do you know what I mean? Like I was never an actress literally in the sense that I didn't do school plays. I was actually an athlete. So that was never even in my, you know, peripheral to think about acting in any way. But yeah, I do think that in hindsight, you know, keeping a relationship with your middle school teacher for 3 years quiet and secretive and having to be in her homeroom and pretend that that's not happening and you're not having a quote unquote intimate relationship, you know, that's acting. So in a weird way, that's what I mean when I say, yeah, I kind of always had to act or was acting and I didn't even know it. But the truth is that acting has been the greatest gift of my life because Susan Batson, you know, an amazing acting coach to many people, including Oprah and Nicole Kidman, happens to be my acting coach and was my first acting class ever years ago. And what she did is allowed me, and not just allowed, but encouraged me to feel. And I was very shut down. I was successful, but I was shut down.
Susan describes you as a chameleon capable of playing anything.
Well, we know I can play a man now.
And you've also played a doctor on the Onion News Network.
Yeah, I played Dr. Mills. That was a great fun role. In fact, I think Ben Stiller did something around that one of those episodes that I did that was just hilarious. I've had a really an amazing time, and certainly used acting in a sense, not consciously, but I think to move through a lot of this complication I had. And it's been a very healthy, emotionally healthy way for me to express a lot of things.
Tina, before we go, I'd like to ask you a little bit about, it says on your book cover that you are the co-founder of Gina Raffaele's Jewelry's mission-driven No More Violence collection. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, my partner is Gina Raffaella, and she's an artist and a jewelry designer. And about 3 years ago, we wanted to do something where we were giving back. We got very inspired and disheartened by all the shootings happening. It started, I think, where we were really like awakened during Ferguson. And then more and more people, you know, just the violence that seems to just have taken over this country, senseless shootings. Anyway, we take bullets, inert bullets, and we transform them into beautiful pieces of jewelry, some with diamonds, you know, some delicate, some very badass. And we give partial proceeds to nonprofits that support peace, like Moms Demand Action and Stop Violence Against Women. So it's all forms of violence. And we just use the bullets as that symbol that we need a lot more peace and love.
We sure do.
Well, yeah. That very much reminds me of what Yoko Ono did with John Lennon's glasses.
Put
the glasses that had splattered blood on display at a gallery for the world to see.
Exactly. And sometimes it takes that sort of, you know, bold statement. And that's what we decided that initially, you know, some of the pieces, as I say, are pretty big and bold, but there's also delicate pieces you wouldn't even know that it was a bullet, but the idea is it's just about transformation. It's just how do we take this symbol?
I mean, I'm looking at the jewelry right now. It's pretty intense. You have an actual bullet in there as a pendant on a necklace.
Yeah. Yeah. And then exactly. And then then we take some and we sort of twist them up and make them more architectural and design like. So, they run the gamut, but yes, anybody can take a look at GinaRaffaella.com and see what we're about. But it's very satisfying to, try to make a difference in whatever way all of us can. And we all can, that's for sure.
For sure. Thank you for your effort in that.
Tina, Alexis, yes. Allen, I really appreciate you taking time to share your extraordinary story with us and talking about this amazing art that you're doing with your partner, Gina.
Yes. Yeah, she's pretty amazing in every way.
Thank you so much for your time and congratulations on the book.
Thank you both so much. It was wonderful to talk with you, really.
Yeah. And the book is, thank you, and the book is out now or is coming out next month?
The book is, the publishing date is February 20th. You can pre-order now everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble and all that. But yes, the actual publishing date is February 20th.
Okay, great. We'll put a link up on our website, too. Thank you.
Fantastic, guys. This was really wonderful. Yeah. Have a lovely night.
Uh-huh. Thank you. You, too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Tina Alexis Allen lives in New York and in Los Angeles.
She's bi-coastal and bi-curious.
Oh, I think she's more than bi-curious. You can get her book, Hiding Out, A Memoir of Drugs, Deception, and Double Lives. Just follow the link on our website, feastoffun.com.
What an extraordinary book.
Mm-hmm.
In talking to other people who have sort of followed her story and the story with her father, it's still not finished in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. We don't know what the nature of her father's relationship with the Vatican mm-hmm. is. Well, and if you read the Daily News story about it, they're just like, Tina, you got to give up the goods. She's still investigating what's going on with her dad and the Vatican.
And she says in the book that the Vatican's records are sealed until 2028. And so perhaps, we'll find out something. And so we'll just check
in
back out with Tina in 10 years and we'll see how that goes. 28. It's 18.
Oh, shoot. 10 years from a decade from now. And we're still all around.
Well, and, the Vatican was very anti-communist, so you can see why he might be going to Russia or to Yugoslavia and doing something, trying to subvert those institutions there. But you never know. We don't know.
I hope if more details of her father's really complicated relationship with the Vatican ever come forward, mm-hmm. I hope that somebody in the future does finish telling the full story, because it seems like we're just getting the tip of the iceberg mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in this extraordinary mm-hmm. Double life that this man had and how he started grooming his daughter to take over the business when he passed away.
Mm-hmm. But the travel industry, well, I don't know if she really wanted to get into it, but also the travel industry really changed in the 90s too.
Yeah, thanks, Orbit.
I want to remind folks, we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus, because your contribution to this program is what makes it happen.
Access thousands upon thousands of extraordinary in-depth interviews with LGBT artists and survivors and their friends and really, fantastic people at Feast of Fun. You owe it to yourself.
Mm-hmm. If you cheat yourself, wait, how's it go?
If you cheat yourself, what is it? If you don't treat yourself, you cheat yourself. Because, really, it's like we have this extraordinary archive and your financial support makes this show possible. We can't do interviews like this without your help. Mm. So if you want to consider making a one-time donation, go to feastoffun.com/donate or consider buying a t-shirt or some of our merchandise at our store, feastoffun.com/store.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone. Take care. We'll be right back.